All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Digital Education Podcast. I'm Eric Elveson. Today, I'm with a friend, Ben Beharin, who's an analyst for Creative Strategies. He's also a writer on Tech Opinions and Time.com. I think Ben is an interesting person to have this conversation with because he consults in the tech world, and he stays on top of that. And we have many conversations about technology. But he's also a parent of a middle school and a high school student. And then he's also a high school tennis coach. So he's integrated not only professionally, immensely in Silicon Valley in the tech world, but he's also, you know, connected with schools and married to a teacher as well. So Ben, thanks for joining me. Big question where I'm just going to start it. And it was my buddy, Tom Arnett, who I've done a couple podcasts with too. You know, he asks his questions, will computers replace teachers? So from a tech side of things, from that outside side of things with AI, with all the cool stuff that's happening, like, what do you see when you look at schools, but then when you look at the tech side?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, I think I'd preface this by saying, you know, and I run in some pretty high tech circles in terms of, you know, executives at all the major companies and VCs that think about this, and nobody believes that AI is anywhere near on the horizon to being something substantial. It's right now, it's such early days. You know, we're decades away from even having to worry about an AI that can engage with a human, feel like a human, things like that. There are certainly interesting aspects of the way that AI is being used today, and I think that I would look at it more, especially on the short-term horizon, like how does learnings or how do educational institutions use AI to better equip teachers and better equip and inform the tools that they use to do better educating? And I think that's a more worthwhile time spent digging into this, because there's a lot of stuff you can do with data. And I think what's going to become very clear about this is a lot of educational institutions that might start to believe that they should start looking at the way that they can use data analytics and AI as a layer on top of that is that they probably just don't actually collect hardly any data. And the reality is that I think they're going to have to take step one and say, you know, can we use technology to get better metrics from both the teacher, from the teaching's perspective of tools that are working, as well as the students in terms of tools that they're using, strengths and assets that we can leverage in terms of the software or the hardware, and use that to collect better data, which then I think will better inform the tool sets as well as just the development programs that we're using to educate students. So I would say, you know, my answer to the question is that's a long way off to even having to worry about. I think the next two decades, you're still just going to see a heavy amount of AI being our friend. We're going to use it to our advantage. We're going to use that for better predictive and analytics and let that intelligence start to reveal things to itself, to ourselves, as what's interesting and what's working, so we don't kind of have to have people sit and data scientists analyze all that data. But that to me is a real short-term opportunity, is just how can educational institutions start collecting the right data, use these new tools that are on the horizon for AI, and then use that to make better decisions, create better plans, maybe even more automated, customized plans for individual students and their different learning styles.
It's a great point, because data, I mean, schools are not using what's available. When you see businesses and when you work with these tech companies, what's a tool that, you know, you use or that you see them use that would be easily translatable into a classroom or into a school that would increase the opportunities for kids and their learning, you know, and your kids go to supposedly a fairly innovative school. So, I mean, what would be the thing that you would say, hey, you know what, schools need to start looking at using some of these different things, or if there's something specific?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things. It's really tough because, to be honest with you, even big organizations do this terribly, because big organizations need to hire still data scientists at this point to take their data, put it into formats that are readable that you can then put on your network and then run some AI algorithms on that and train that for something specific. So it's like, that's why I say like, we're so early stages in this. It's like, there are so many fundamental building blocks that still have to happen, but that doesn't mean you can't start somewhere, right? I think educations that are standardizing on Google Classroom, for example, or Google products, right? Google is increasingly making the tools for analytics better on Google services. So I think they're one in which you can learn some of these things. I think even Apple themselves, for those that are on, you know, Apple Classroom and whatnot, is looking at doing better analytics to translate, you know, how much time are they spending in one app, you know, things like that. So there's the starting points of this, but I think one of the problems that most educational institutions that I go into and have talks with is that there's still fragmented pieces of the solution that's being put together on top of the technology that they're using. So it could be one school's using some Google Classroom, some Apple Classroom, some random service that they've bought from somewhere else. And so there's really no standard, right? The cleanest implementations that I've seen just happen to be schools that standardize both on iPads and Apple Classroom. And so they go through the process of being a distinguished school, which Apple gives a designation to, distinguished Apple specific school. And so they're getting a more holistic and complete solution because they're defining what they're using based on parameters that Apple's helping them set. But even there's not a ton of data, but at least it's not a sprinkle of Google Classroom, a sprinkle of some open source thing, a sprinkle of Google. Like there's no continuity there, right? It's just kind of all hodgepodge together. And to some degree, this is a limitation of some of the tools that we have too, is that there's not great educational suites of software that come together and cover all of the bases for different curriculums, individual learning styles. So I just see a lot of this is still kind of hacked together. And so I think the technology industry has a long way to go to bring continuity to the services. Luckily, you know, kids are so dynamic that they can embrace all these random things. Like if you put, like I do this with my kids who are right in iPad schools, if you gave that to a person in an enterprise and ask them to do the same thing, they would have no idea, like literally no idea. It's such a dramatically different workflow, but they're so spongy at this stage. They can take all these random and disconnected solutions and make use of them. But there's a long way to go in just cleaning up how we deploy and give students a continuity of experience that we can then collect data on that can better analyze reasons they might struggle with something, right? And that would be a good use of AI, which is, you know, can you tell me, not the teacher having to do it, but can you see how they're reading or even analyze how they've answered this question, writing it out right on their tablet with their pencil and see where they went wrong, you know, bring in some insights as, okay, this is what this person's struggling with, and just better insight and intelligence. But we're, like I said, we're a long way up from that reality, but stuff like that, I think is where we're going.
So when you were in high school, go back, because we were at your 20-year reunion, right? And so go back to when you were in high school. You were messing around with all kinds of stuff 20 years ago. You know, you did radio, you did, you know, the technology stuff. You were kind of starting your own business in the tech world. Internet was, you know, it was fun hearing the stories from your high school reunion. But like, how much actually has your daughter's education and what they go through changed, even though like these tech platforms and all this it has changed?
I mean, it's really not, right? It's the same paradigms just brought to digital. You know, they take their math test on an iPad and write out these answers on a worksheet and submit it. Like, okay, that's all that's doing is simplifying the process. It's digitizing an analog process and making math digital, right? There's no real change to how it's taught. There's no real change to some of the underlying structures. I think the only thing that's come along that I think is really interesting, but it skews more toward multimedia, right? The way that they're doing photography in their photography class is changing. The way that they're doing presentations now in real time is great. It's more interactive, but again, right, it's just sort of a digital process of something we used and maybe did slides or printouts for, that they're just translating that, right? But they're making movies now. That's part of the educational process. I think the one thing that's fundamentally changed, and I still think is probably the lowest hanging fruit of really interesting opportunity for education, is to truly embrace collaboration more within group settings digitally. Because, you know, they don't ask students to video conference, for example, right, in real time in classroom. But yet I watch my students do that, my girls do that at home. They use FaceTime, they video conference with their friends to do homework. And that's a part of a workflow. It's a very simple one. But the idea that you can be in a group and do homework while remotely, collaborate on a document in in Google Docs, not have to like send that sheet or be together, right, has been, I think, a real big step forward in digital around collaboration. But even in the workforce, this is really not something that's been innovated upon outside of anything that's just basic. You know, we've digitized something that used to be analog, or we've streamlined a process for, you know, email has moved to chat channels, for example. So it's the same underlying stuff. What I'm still waiting for is like, what's the new, like what all of this empowers us to do stuff we've never really done before. And we're seeing shades of this with things like augmented reality. If you look at what HoloLens is doing, where we can all put on a pair of goggles and sit in the same room, feel virtually in the same room, look up at stickies and whiteboards in the same room. Like that stuff gets really, really interesting, but we're a ways off from that. But I think that kind of stuff's really exciting about technology leading to collaboration, which can then lead to new forms of learning, new forms of creation, new forms of productivity and creativity that we just haven't been able to do before, largely in an analog world.
So let me ask you this question then, because it's this balance, and you live in this tech world, and you're always trying and using new products and looking at how things work and how things connect and, you know, and just how it works in the world. Like, as a parent, but then also these conversations of like, how much is too much technology, or where do you just kind of, you know, take the technology out and then just simplify back to, I mean, whether it's old school, but not to necessarily make it the boring old school, but where's that balance of too much technology versus maybe the right amount?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's going to vary by students, I think. I mean, I think there's definitely stuff that, you know, we need to be worried about. You know, Minecraft's a really good example, right? You could make the case that Minecraft is an incredibly productive tool in terms of both learning, collaborating, building, problem solving, etc., right? And that's all great, but at the same time, you don't want people playing Minecraft, right, for 8 hours a day. There's other stuff they should be doing. But it's a great tool, you know? I mean, if kids want to read together, right, that's a great use of technology. They could use that for productive terms. So I feel like there's always going to be a strain of technology allows us to be efficient, more productive, get things done faster that didn't take time. And that's just going to be the, you know, the standard. When you start trying to get into some of the stuff where technology goes a little bit south, where social media might come into play and other things, then I think those are the kind of things that understanding the limitations and the barriers for, you know, for using those things for good and, you know, start to get in the way. So, and it's interesting too, because I know this isn't necessarily something that every bit does. I think, again, there's one part of technology that I think becomes really, really clear for this is that, you know, I think it's an underappreciated philosophy general that the learning styles vary just so different by student to student. And I really hope, you know, my wife does this because she teaches special ed, so she has to have an individual lesson plan for every single student. It's crafted uniquely for all six or seven of her students. The reality is, if technology can help a teacher craft a similar thing based on the lesson plan she has, but maybe some alterations, and maybe do that for them, for the unique learning styles of each student, I think we're going to make a whole lot of progress in that direction to then also weave that into a productive use of technology. So if it's, you know, you're going to read digitally, or you might watch this, you know, or you might put on VR and go see what it was like to live in Lincoln's age, for example. Like, that's great. It's fun. It's engaging. It leaves memorable experiences. It has the power to teach and influence the minds positively in that way. But it's also technology, right? So I think there's this sort of balance between what's a productive use, what's an unproductive use. And students, I think, are feeling this out too. They're learning what's good for them. They're learning what's, you know, and sometimes putting limits on themselves, which I think is interesting. And they're learning to self-govern, you know, how much screen time they've felt is too much. So they're going through this learning process as well and being really absorbing more of this digital stuff than many of our older peers and starting to make life adjustments from that too.
So as we close up, you know, maybe ask you for a tip from the tech world. Like, what's coming? What do you see? Like, what can you share with us that might like help educators in particular understand a world that sometimes seems foreign to them? Well, is foreign to them, but also seems a little bit, you know, scary to many of them. I know a lot of them, you know, embrace it, love it. They're, you know, on the cutting edge of a lot of the technology and education, but yeah. I'd say the majority that I meet, that it worries them. It makes them nervous. It's not what, you know, they're prepped for. They love the people side of things or the content of their subject matter. Like, what's a tip in the tech world that's just coming that saying, hey, you know what, watch out for this or look for this or prepare because this is going to be fun.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the biggest things coming, and it's going to be around collaboration in the short term, is just their ability to be, call it virtual, you know, virtually more present in real time with their students. You know, as their students are engaging in questions or doing learning, just the ability for them to either have a, you know, a chat room. I know some of them do this with blogs now. They might publish some things and a lot of it's done through email. But, you know, as call it things like Slack or Microsoft Teams start to come into the educational environment and be used for sort of real-time messaging, threading, collaboration, you know, even that a teacher in their off hours or when they're, you know, being available, right, to have quote-unquote office hours and do so virtually, that they can be in a Slack room for their students and if they want, initiate a video conference and just have 2 minutes, right? So to answer those questions, because I really feel like that is something that the students want and the teachers want, and it's also the hardest thing. Like, I know my kids always are like, I got a question, and we can't answer it because sometimes she's doing math that we've forgotten about. And so we're sitting there going like, I don't know how to answer this question. So she's FaceTiming people trying to figure out who can help her answer this question, when if she could just get 3 minutes, right, with the teacher right then, is so much more productive than her waiting till the end of day tomorrow and then going there and then waste, you know, the teacher trying to get out the door. So I think that real-time collaboration and being an assistance and a way to really be there for the students is probably going to be one of the most effective things they can do, low hanging fruit, you know. And then the other side is just to not, you know, to not be afraid of the technology that's coming, because this generation really does learn in a different way. You know, I really think, especially for things like history, like one of the things we've been thinking a lot about is virtual reality for history becomes really interesting, because companies could create entire virtual worlds of again, like what it was like in the Civil War, or what it was like, you know, coming across on a boat during immigration, right? So they can simulate these worlds that will help these kids grasp the more significance of these events, both historically or even just, right, society. What's it like to be in Paris? And so these are the kind of things that become immersive and can really get minds thinking. But multimedia is the other thing that I think can just be used better. It's really misunderstood at this point. I think using multimedia in a way to help kids because they're engaged with it, they're used to it, is another thing that I think is low-hanging fruit that really caters to how they learn, and also can give teachers tools to ingrain some things that embed into curriculum. But they're going to have to go find that, right? That's what I think is interesting. You're going to have to go experience these things from the student's perspective to say, yes, I just saw this, you know, immersive video that you can watch that's, I think, a really great thing on Civil War or something. And they got to experience it and say, I can use that as a learning tool.
So how'd the tennis team do?
We finished 500. Which was great. I think everybody learned a lot. We're building toward, I think, a pretty solid team for next year. Kaylee did pretty well. She also ended around 500, which was pretty good for her first season playing number one singles. And everybody's pretty optimistic about what the team will look like next year. So we're a lot to build upon.
Ben, thanks for spending this time with me, and I'll see you on Saturday.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
See you, Ben.